Okay, great. So tonight is May 8th, right, 2012. I'm Rick Hansen, and
I
want... Ninth, thank you. It's the ninth, see? Ninth. Stuck in the past, that's me. Anyway, ninth. Okay, it's May 9th, and tonight's topic is equanimity. I would like to introduce that topic with a bit of a story. It's a traditional story. It's to imagine a tall tower with six windows. And inside this tower, with no escape, is a monkey. And this monkey darts from window to window. There's six windows, and there are only six windows. And through this window, the monkey sees sights. And through this window, the monkey hears sounds. Through this window, the monkey feels feelings. Through this window, the monkey smells smells. Through this window, the monkey tastes tastes. And through this window, the monkey thinks thoughts, thoughts broadly defined, including emotions, the pleasantness or unpleasantness of experiences, imagery, memories, plans, worries, lofty aspirations, and all of it. And that's the tower. That's the tower of the mind. And this particular monkey, as monkeys are, is continually looking for something good and is continually afraid of something bad or worried about something bad. So the monkey darts from window to window, continually searching for something good and searching also to ward off anything bad. And the monkey, of course, darting from window to window, sense gate to sense gate, including the sixth sense gate, as it were, to the mind, is somewhat frantic, somewhat anxious. That's a good word, frantic. I'll remember that word, frantic and anxious. Driven. Yeah, my mouth was smarter than my brain. But anyway, that's our monkey, right? And the monkey's worn out because at any moment there could be something new. And when this monkey is looking through this particular window, the monkey's anxious about what could be available in that window. And looking through that window, the monkey is driven to make sure there's no missed opportunity or no missed threat through those windows and that window and that window. Who does the monkey remind us of? This is a traditional metaphor for the human condition with monkey mind. Abiding in our tall tower with nothing knowable except that which is seen or perceived or experienced or heard or thought through one of these six windows. The monkey, the human, at least in this body, in this life, has no choice about that condition. Six windows stuck in this tower, certainly in terms of ordinary, everyday consciousness, and with no alternative but to be with the situation in one way or another. That's the fate. The ordinary condition, as we know, is to have monkey mind. As we'll see in a little bit, monkey mind is natural mind because we're all woo-hoo monkeys, you know, the hairless ape, as it were. The ordinary condition is a condition of suffering, as the Buddha taught, endlessly caught up in craving, desire, reactivity to whatever is apparent through one of these six windows. That's the ordinary condition. The alternative, though, is to wake up as that monkey in the tower and to participate in a different way with what's available through these various windows, through these six windows. And that's the essence of equanimity, which is the seventh in the standard list of the Buddhist factors of awakening, of enlightenment. It's the end of the list because in some ways it's the most fundamental, the most far-reaching, and the most profound. The ordinary sense of equanimity is one of basic calm and basic ease and balance. Actually, I had someone use that word a little earlier today with me, inadvertently, not knowing our topic tonight. Someone had complimented her about having equanimity, a basic ease, particularly in a fairly high-stress situation where most people don't have that much equanimity. The more technical and deeper Buddhist meaning of that word is ultimately a profound and irrevocable non-reactivity to whatever moves through the mind, no matter how pleasant or unpleasant it is. It doesn't mean numbness. It doesn't mean apathy. One enjoys what's pleasant, and one dislikes or finds painful what's unpleasant, but one doesn't react to those things in a way that's unbalanced. One may seek to increase or continue the wholesome pleasant for oneself and others. One may naturally seek to take the hand off the hot plate, right? That's unpleasant, that's perfectly natural and appropriate. But to do so without losing one's balance, without being that monkey in the tower, chasing one sensation after another. That's the essence of equanimity. The Buddha observed in his analysis of experience, which we can see ourselves, it's not a mystical analysis, that moment to moment various stimuli occur, various stimuli are perceptible through the six windows. And then naturally enough, there's on the heels of that bare arising, the bare knowing of whatever that is, that there's something there. Something has happened. There's a sound, there's a smell, there's a sight, there's a thought. On the basis of that, very quickly, is a quality of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. What's called in Western psychology, the hedonic tone, or in Buddhist psychology, the feeling tone, or in Pali, the language of the earliest surviving written record of the Buddha's teachings, the vedanas. Vedanas being the pleasantness, unpleasantness, or neutrality of experience. And then in the Buddha's observation, in the sequence that goes from stimulus to the hedonic tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, on the heels of that is a kind of liking or disliking, and on the heels of that is a wanting, a craving, a wanting for the pleasant to continue or grow, a wanting for the unpleasant to end, and on the heels of that is a kind of drivenness that moves into craving and clinging and then suffering. That's the Buddhist analysis. So the opportunity in this sequence is to install a kind of shock absorber between the feeling tone that's inherent, basically, in most experiences. Certainly in the moment, it's what is there. Is to install a kind of shock absorber between that feeling tone and the tipping into, the losing of our balance into, grasping after what's unpleasant or pushing away, going at war with, having fear or anger about what's unpleasant. That's when trouble begins. That's the essence of equanimity. It's the shock absorber. In the brain, that primary producer, the feeling tone is produced throughout the brain, basically, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The emotional system, the limbic system, reactor to that which is pleasant or unpleasant, is very ancient. It reaches down into the earliest portions of the mammalian brain, and actually down further into the brainstem base of the reptilian or fruit fly brain. Okay? Fruit flies have a million neurons in their brain. They have a brain too. It's very small, but they do indeed have a brain. So way down deep, there are ancient rapid systems that quickly register, is this unpleasant? Fight or flight, get away. Is this pleasant? Chase after it. Just like that. So they're continually tracking pleasant, unpleasant, and they're continually tipping into what the Buddha would call craving and clinging. That's the natural monkey mind. It's a very effective way to keep cavemen and cavewomen, hominids, primates, mammals, reptiles, dinosaurs, to keep them alive to pass on their genes. But today produces a lot of suffering for us. What are we going to do about it? So to put this in perspective, I want to talk a bit about the nature of equanimity itself and then talk about what to do about it. Okay? So I'll say a word or two about the nature of equanimity itself, see if you have any questions or comments about that, and then following the lead of the Buddha, who is, if nothing else, eminently practical, let's talk about what to do about it. Okay? So First, I want to talk about the balance of mindfulness and equanimity. With mindfulness, we're simply present with what's there. It's very foundational. It's very important. With equanimity, or the cultivation of equanimity, there's a gradual cultivation of non-reactivity to what's there. We're not simply aware of what's there, but increasingly, we're not reactive around it. We're not upset by it. In the language of the Buddha, it doesn't invade the mind and remain. It may be momentarily pleasant or unpleasant, but it doesn't invade the mind and remain. We don't get angry about it. We don't worry about it. We don't continue to be sad about it. Or if what is naturally arising is a moment of irritation or a moment of fear or a moment of sadness, we don't create a secondary cascade of reactions to that primary reaction. We don't, in the metaphor of the Buddha, throw second, third, fourth, and fifth darts. The first dart lands. There might be a physical pain. There might be a momentary flare of anger. Who put the chair in front of my path in the middle of the night? Because maybe somebody actually did. Maybe that somebody was you, but that thought sinks in a few seconds after the flare of anger. Okay, there is that. But fairly quickly, the cascade dampens in the shock absorber effect, or the, I think of it as the mud room. You know, on the East Coast, they have these things called mud rooms. You come in from the outside. You're in the house, so it's in the mind, as it were, but it's the mud room. That's where you leave the galoshes and the dripping coats and the boots and the skis and the mud, and the dog shakes off and whatever. That's in the mud room, and then it doesn't go into the center of the house. So with equanimity, there's that dampening cascade, and we're not putting more logs on the fire. More logs of anger or fear or greedy grasping or heartache. So that's the balance of mindfulness and equanimity. And I actually had someone write me a question about this, and I wrote him back, and I thought it might be worth just listening to what I wrote him back. I said, to use the language of Buddhism, there is a place for right mindfulness, but also a place for right effort. He's asking me about the balance between the two. Mindfulness is the doorway to equanimity, which is gradually developed as virtue, concentration, and wisdom deepen. Those are the three pillars of practice in Buddhism: virtue, concentration, and wisdom. Along this path, we also need to pull weeds and plant flowers in the garden of the mind. In other words, right effort. Cultivating wholesome states and factors of mind, by activating them, installing them through taking in the good, and then reactivating and reinstalling them again and again on life's path, in a wonderful positive cycle, is a kindness to oneself and others. With time, the fruits of this process of cultivation become increasingly second nature, woven into the fabric of the brain, the body, and the mind. Then conscious cultivation, in other words, right effort, gradually falls away, and we abide without effort in spacious, balanced, peaceful, beautiful equanimity. That's the process. So you see the balance there of mindfulness and equanimity. One more thing about equanimity, also in context, and then I'll get into some practical stuff. This is a quote from Ajahn Tanisaro, who's an American, studied in Southeast Asia for a long time. He's in San Diego, sometimes known as Jeff DeGraff. I think that was his birth name. That's on his birth certificate. He's a very deep person, practitioner and teacher. And he also freely offers many, many translations. And his book, by the way, Wings to Awakening, is a masterpiece, I think, of practice. He goes into the specific factors that show up again and again on the various Buddhist lists, and he really unpacks them. It's a dense book. You know, I read it a half page at a time. It took me probably about a year and a half to kind of make my way through it, but it was very rewarding. It's accessible, but it's like you read that half page and you go, okay, that's good for now. We're going to let that sink in for a while. We're going to let that one just kind of resonate, bang around inside the echo chamber here for a while. Good. Okay. Anyway, so he had this to say about equanimity. He said, if you think that a non-reactive state of mind is in touch with the true nature of things as they are, which is how mindfulness is often portrayed, you're basically making equanimity your ultimate meditative tool, you know, non-reactive state of mind. But as the Buddha said, equanimity can handle only some of the causes of suffering. There are many other causes that require the effort of analysis and thought, the cultivation of wisdom and insight. What he termed the exertion of fabrication. You're fabricating things in your mind, but to a good end. Some people think that the point, certainly of Buddhist practice, maybe spiritual practice altogether, is a kind of quiescence. Right? And the Buddha he spoke strongly against that, and he pointed out, for example, that therefore a sleeping baby would be the epitome of awakening. You know, and well, a sleeping baby is pretty neat. There's some wisdom there, but it's not what we would think of as enlightened consciousness necessarily. Okay? He says, Ajahn Jeff says, if you limit yourself to equanimity, there will be many causes of suffering that will simply hide out without getting uprooted. And in fact, equanimity can become an object of clinging, a kind of quiescence, a kind of peace. You know, I've known myself, I've lived in California my entire adulthood, most of my life, and I've known quite a few people in spiritual or New Age circles who have this inner peace they cling to, like the Soviet Union clung to the Warsaw Pact states, you know, and the Berlin Wall. I mean, they guard their inner peace, you know, with guns. Like, okay, that's a problem. If you don't see that, as Ajahn Jeff says, you shut the door to total release. So I want to put equanimity in context here. It's very, very important, but it's not to be clung to, and there's more to practice than simply non-reactivity. Okay? So any comments or questions so far about the nature of equanimity and its point? Please. The Buddha would call that the first art. And you're talking here about a quote-unquote negatively valenced experience, you know, although there's something beautiful as well about some things you're talking about. We could use a different example. What about the enormous joy at something, your wedding day or the birth of a child? Or
equally balanced, right?
Yeah.
But still, how does that balance with equanimity?
Equanimity is the space in which that natural wave arises, exists, persists, and then passes away without any addition of suffering to it. That's very, very important to appreciate. The Buddha did not. That's the point of the middle way. His personal path in his 7 years of practice was quiescence, in an ascetic Jain path of just trying to shut down all experiencing, including to the point of death. That was the point of that path, to absolutely turn down the volume to the zero point. The Buddha's realization was that that would not lead to ultimate awakening. And in fact, on the getting very close, on the run-up to, a critical moment for him was the recollection, as you may know, of a memory from his boyhood, where he was apparently at some festival sitting under a tree, and he tipped into a bliss state. He had a very pleasant upwelling of joy. And he realized that this is not to be avoided. This is not a block to ultimate awakening. It's in fact an aid to it. It was a jhana state, probably, a basic bliss state. It's a very important point. And I think for those of us living in the West who are engaging passions of various kinds, wholesome aspirations, the teachings of equanimity are really useful. For example, to aspire without attachment. Pursue wholesome ends without getting attached to them. To live in a world that allows pleasant and unpleasant to pass through the mind, because we're participating in life. That's equanimity has much to offer here, including, frankly, the cautionary tale that we have a brain that evolved to want. Organisms that did not have strong wants did not pass on their genes. They did not live to see the sunrise. We have a brain that is trained to learn from pleasant, to chase after it. It's very effective and efficient at learning where carrots are and grasping after them, and it's especially efficient, particularly efficient, at learning where the sticks are and learning how to fight them or flee from them or freeze around them. So I think it's important. I know people as well, maybe also because I live in California, who are very glib about Tantra and the life of the passions and exploring desire. And yet, they really are underestimating the dark side of the force, because they're underestimating the power of the brain to lock onto that and to subtly keep going after it. So if we're going to engage the senses, we need to really, really do it on top of our game. We really, really need to be equanimous. So how to do it? So let's make sure my tape recorder is still working. Good. I'm retaining my equanimity. So I wanted to frame this a little bit in that, so in a model that's really been helpful for me, personal practice as well as my own teaching thinking, is a model that looks at three fundamental drives that humans have, three fundamental motivations: to avoid harms, to approach rewards, and attach to others. These three drives loosely correlate with the three stages of evolution of the brain, the three floors of the house of the brain. The first floor being the brainstem, reptilian, very effective at avoiding harms. Next level, limbic system, early mammalian layer of the brain, second floor of the brain. Very good at pursuing rewards in even more effective ways, more subtly revved up and revved down ways. And then, of course, we have the primate, and especially human, massive explosion of the cortex of the brain, which has tripled in volume since our ancestors first began manufacturing stone tools about 2.5 million years ago. And that explosion of cortex is really focused on attaching to others. So there's a loose correlation. But what we're left with today is a whole brain that is very organized around avoiding harms, attaching to others, and approaching rewards. Okay? We don't have a choice about that. We may have the brain of a Buddha, but the brain of a Buddha is built to avoid harms, approach rewards, and attach to others. The only question is, what's the mode of activation of that brain? In what mode, or in what way, in what setting, is it avoiding harms, approaching rewards, or attaching to others? And it's clear to me, and I think many others in science and so forth, that when the brain is not disturbed, when we're not disturbed by pain, hunger, loss, or threat or frustration, the brain defaults to its resting state. I and sometimes others have called that the responsive mode of the brain. That's our home base, characterized by a basic feeling of peacefulness, happiness, and love in terms of those three needs: avoiding harms, approaching rewards, and attaching to others. Peacefulness, happiness, and love. And a state in which the body repairs and refuels itself so it can continue to engage life. In this responsive mode, we're engaged with life, but on the basis of a fundamental equanimity. We're not disturbed. We can even be responsive about reactions moving through us. We're not disturbed by them. They don't invade the mind and remain. On the other hand, Mother Nature has also endowed us with a brain that, like that, can leave home, tip out of that responsive mode, into a basic state of anger and fear in terms of avoiding harms, where we feel threatened, into a basic state of chasing and craving and disappointment and frustration and drivenness in terms of the approaching reward system, and a basic state of what I call heartache. Right? I don't call it, I use that word to kind of encompass the disturbances when we feel voted off the island, unloved, unseen, unappreciated, disrespected, longing for love, trying to get blood from a stone. What happens there? Right. If you think about it, I'm trying to operationalize in a framework of evolutionary neuropsychology the causes of suffering and the causes of its end in the brain. Right? What are the causes of hatred, greed, heartache, wrapped with delusion? Or alternately, what are the causes of peacefulness, happiness, and love wrapped with wisdom? Okay, that's a framework here. So in that framework, I want to talk about two different kinds of ways to come home. In the first way, we explore what it's like to experience and gradually cultivate the causes of a feeling of being already safe. So there's already no basis for reactive activation related to threat. We're not disturbed in terms of the avoiding harm system. So there are various ways to cultivate a deepening sense of safety. For one, it means intervening out in the world and getting locks for the front door, right? Building up a little money for retirement, having a bit of a cushion, some water in the garage, whatever. You know, there are things to do out there, great. But especially in the mind. I know a lot of people who are quite wealthy by any kind of normal standard who feel very worried about money. They don't feel safe financially, even though by any rational standard, they're really okay. So what do we do in the mind? Well, this is where cultivating the recognition of protections comes in, cultivating a relaxation in the body comes in, cultivating a kind of a sense of noticing that one is all right now, right in this moment, all right, when one is, and one is most of the time, all right now. We gradually cultivate a sense of safety, and we also gradually disengage from contentiousness with others. We give no other person cause to fear us. We're not at war with anyone. We still may speak truth to power. We still may stand up. We still may be counted upon, but we don't do it on the basis of feeling threatened in a fundamental sense. So we do various things to cultivate a sense of safety. We could spend a day on that, and sometimes I do, actually. Okay. Second thing we try to cultivate is a sense of being already happy, broadly defined, already full. In other words, we notice the enoughness of this breath. There's plenty of oxygen to go around in this moment. We recognize the basic enoughness in our life. Not millionaires, not have every dream come true, but basically a fullness in one's life. Feelings of gladness or gratitude come in. Sense of appreciating the blessings that we do have comes in. We pursue wholesome aims and really try to register it when we accomplish them, whether it's getting a load of laundry done. One of my secrets is that I really enjoy doing dishes. It's a very simple task. I can get it done, start to finish. It's all good, okay? It's really simple. We can get that done, you know? Or we can get an email done, or we can start a project, or we can do something. So we take in a sense of goal attainment. We're already attained. We're already full. There's already an enoughness. So we feel already happy, and we're not disturbed in terms of the approaching reward system. There's no place, there's no basis or ground for disappointment or frustration to hook in. We also can find a sense of being already loved and already loving. Because love is much the same, isn't it? Remarkably, whether it's coming in or going out. Loved and loving. So we do little things again in a real world in which, you know, as John Wellwood puts it, perfect love in perfect relationships. Right? Where we, for example, try to call up the felt sense of being cared about or included in the ways that it's true, either in the past or the present. Belonging with friends, we go through our day, we try to not let slip through our mind like water through a sieve a smile from another person or a warm gaze or a sense of their goodwill, ordinary basic goodwill. We try to not let that go through. We try to help the mind, therefore the brain, be sticky for it in a very good way. We cultivate loving kindness in our own heart. We cultivate compassion for others, kindness for others. We wish them well. You know, love is the same coming in or going out, remarkably. So over time, we gradually have a sense of being already loved and loving. So there too, there's no basis for disturbance in terms of the attaching to other system. We cultivate that over time. So that at bottom, we kind of expand the sphere of experiences. I'm paraphrasing Upandita here. He says, Buddhist practice is essentially about expanding the sphere of situations or experiences in which we are free. Free meaning we are non-reactive, meaning we are fundamentally equanimous. We're participating, but on the basis of a freedom. We're expanding that out. So that's what we do. We're expanding the sphere in which we feel basically already peaceful, happy, and loving. Now, that's good, right? That's good. But if you're like me and you've explored this, you can still sense a subtle, quality of tension in this effort, a subtle quality of an impermanence in the states of mind of being fundamentally peaceful, happy, and loving. We're making an effort. We gradually plant those seeds. They grow. They increasingly condition consciousness so that we're more and more stably in that space. But still, here too, subtly, it's conditional. And if it's conditional, it's ultimately an unreliable basis for complete happiness, which is the ultimate point of the Buddhist path. As the Buddha said repeatedly, using the metaphor of a tree, you know, don't just stop with the bark of, let's say, everyday ordinary happiness. Don't just stop with the inner layers of the trunk of the tree, meditative attainments, bliss states, insight experiences. Go all the way to the heartwood of the tree, which is ultimate, irrevocable awakening. Go all the way. So how do we go all the way with equanimity? I mean, hey, basic peacefulness, happiness, and love is good. A basically responsive brain state compared to the reactive mode of fight or flight and all the rest of that is a good thing. But it's not the ultimate basis. It's not the unconditional basis. So I want to offer that. I want to offer some notions about that most unconditional basis. So I'll offer four. One way into equanimity is through the felt recognition of the utter impermanence of everything, the utter transience of everything, instant by instant, the utter vanishingness beneath our feet of this moment, gone. You know, there's a mantra of sorts, a fundamental famous teaching, gate, gate, para gate, para samgate, bodhi, svaha. Gate means gone. Gone, gone, gone. Beyond the gone, beyond the farthest gone, there, Buddha nature. That's what that mantra means, essentially. So in the recognition, the felt recognition, the course deepens over time of utter transience, we find a growing equanimity because it's hopeless to grasp after anything. We live on the lip of a waterfall with every moment of now rushing past us, and it's gone as soon as we reach for it. And after a while, there's such a fundamental bone-deep sense of that transience, we kind of gradually become disenchanted with the whole project. We gradually give up and relax around it and become increasingly equanimous. In other words, it's in the enduring nature of things to be transient. It's not in the enduring nature of things for a human animal to be always peaceful, happy, and loving. But it is in the ultimate nature of things for them to be always transient. Second, it's in the nature of things in an ongoing kind of way to be interconnected. Everything is connected always to everything else. What is not always connected to everything else? There is only one allness. At any moment in time, there is only one allness. That's really true. Really, there's only one allness. It contains all these various parts, but there's only one whole. Whatever it is, including in ways that we are way beyond our ken, but whatever it is, there's only one allness, right? And in the recognition of that as well, one lightens up about what's happening in any part of it. One doesn't become apathetic. One doesn't just go, oh, it's all wonderful. Well, no, actually, kids are starving. That's not so wonderful. We do things about it. But there's only one allness in which kids are starving. And that, too, takes us to a growing non-reactivity to any part of the allness. However shiny and pretty and wonderful it is, or dreadful or awful or horrific it is, it's in a context of only one allness. So we abide increasingly in the allness, in only one allness. Third thing that's always true is particularly difficult to talk about because it's what the Buddha called the unconditioned, beyond language, the deathless, the world of the realm of Nibbana. The Buddha said that there were, I think he said, four realities, basically. The reality of materiality, the reality of ordinary mind, the reality of the heaven realms. In Buddhist cosmology, there are 36 levels. We're at the sixth. There are 30 above us, you know. And the fourth reality, Nibbana. So it's seen as a kind of reality. I think of it as that which is eternally present just before the emergence of this instant. It's the stillness out of which everything that moves arises and then passes away instantly. It's the unconditioned. It's that which is not conditioned. It's a trap, and it's a well-understood trap in Buddhism to reify the unconditioned, even the way language makes it, the unconditioned. It's very important to be very careful about this, even if we use useful fictions, like a phrase like the deathless, or the beyond, as if we know what that means, you know. But see for yourself what you think is true. It's clear to me that there must be something prior to everything that emerges eternally always. One way to think of it at the quantum level is that quantum particles, the sort of quivering foam at the edge of emergence into actuality, live in a state of potentiality, which one thing can be in three places or an infinite number of places at once. It's quantum potentiality, this foaminess, just prior to coalescence into actuality, which then, boom, boom, is gone. Right? At that edge, right, at that edge, there's an unconditioned. It could be anything. It's not yet conditioned. It's easy to intellectualize about it. It's much better to, over time, have an intuition, which often comes in a flash. As soon as you try to analyze it and look for it, it disappears, because then we've reified it. We've made it into something conditioned. But as the Buddha says, in that my mind delights, the unconditioned. So I think of it as space. A way to think of it as space. Like at an emotional level, there's like space in which things happen. Okay, that's the third doorway to equanimity that's grounded in that which doesn't change, I think. And the fourth and last is our own mysterious and yet palpable own Buddha nature. The Buddha has this quote I want to read to you as I move to a wrap here. He says, "Know this, O good one. Evil things are difficult to control. Let not greed and wickedness drag you to protracted misery." So it's got four lines here, basically. Know this, O good one. So I'll come back to that. Evil things are difficult to control, kind of statement about the way things are. And then his practical advice, let not greed and wickedness drag you to protracted misery. But how does he address us? He doesn't say, O ye sinners. A common statement is, O nobly born. Other people would talk about, O sons and daughters of the Buddha. O good one. Right? O ye who have little dust in their eyes. That's another traditional phrase. That's us. In each of us, again, it's a trap to reify it or essentialize it or try to over-language it or intellectualize around it. But there's an intuition of a capacity to know that which is true. And some kind of language fails us, some kind of place, some kind of knowing, some kind of something, some kind of awareness that feels fundamentally free in the space of all these things happening, all these things moving around, all these things changing. There's something that feels stably free of all that. The Buddha strongly spoke against reifying that into some eternal soul essence. See for yourself what you think. But simply regarding that, perhaps as like a kind of standing wave that has some continuity to it, even as it's itself quivers a bit and changes moment to moment, but there's a stability to that innate capacity for knowing and for freedom. Ultimately, what I talked about, you know, the jewel in the lotus, peace based on insight and non-reactivity, and the lotus itself, which is love. Or the lotus is, yeah, the lotus, the jewel is the love. The lotus is the knowing, the peace. Right? That's a traditional image there. So in us is that capacity. So I'd like to maybe just rest here with you for a minute, and I'll just offer four words and see if they speak to you at all. We'll just sit quietly for a minute or so, and then we'll wrap up this evening. Okay? Okay. So, actually, I'll do it in this way. I'll offer seven words, all right, with about 15 seconds between each one. And just see kind of what happens for you, and maybe even explore a kind of giving over to that which is true. So here we go. Already peaceful. Already happy, including subtle forms of contentment. Already loved and loving. Already letting go. Already everything. Already space. Already Buddha. Thank you for your attention and be well.